Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. Happy New Year. This is Curtis B. Wayne, your host. 2012 was a really good year. Thank you all for listening. This has become the most listened to serious architectural program in the known universe. We have about 5 million hits so far. Thank you all very much for your continued listening. Today I want to speak with the, Dutch-American. Are you an American or are you still just a Dutch architect? Is it Winka or Vinka?
Winka.
Winka Dubbeldam, who is, your office is here in New York City, isn't it?
Yeah, my office is here, but I'm completely Dutch, as you can hear, probably.
Well, that's okay. I would greet you in your native language, but my command of Nederlands is limited to ordering smoked eel sandwiches and basic stuff like that.
Very important, yeah, you know, this
absolutely
gets down to basics.
Yeah, that was my when I was in Amsterdam back in the 20th century, being a young brash opera designer, my first and last foray into real theater, I was introduced to brooches.
Okay. Haring, probably.
And no, it was Paling.
Paling, yeah.
Yeah, smoked eel. It was great.
Nice, yeah.
Loved it. So you were starting to tell me about a little bit of how it is that you came to the United States. Let's hear a little bit about your history.
Sure. I have been in and out of the U.S. Actually, as a kid, I was here a few times too. I lived with my aunt and uncle in New York for about 3 months.
Uh-huh.
Did a little exchange with school in Holland, in Chicago. Lived there for 3, 4, or 5 months maybe. And then finally decided one day that I really wanted to do a postgraduate study in the U.S. And applied both in SciArc in L.A. and New York, and decided New York was definitely where I wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
And that was 1990, so you can imagine, ever since I've been here, forgot to go back, you could say.
Who was dean at Columbia at that time? Was Shumi up there?
Yeah, Shumi was there, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, he did a little time also at my alma mater, my undergraduate alma mater, Cooper Union.
Yeah, yeah.
After the passing away of John Haydick. So you've been here pretty much ever since, huh?
Yeah, I did my postgraduate, worked for Peter Eisenman, Stephen Hall, and Shumi.
Mm.
I did a little scan through New York and learned a lot from all three, I would say.
How did you like working for Peter?
I loved working for Peter.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I really, you know, what I really admire, and the reason why I wanted to work for Peter, is that I actually came to the U.S. because I felt like Holland is a great design country, but intellectually or like theory-wise, we're kind of not limited, but there's a very few people interested in it.
Really?
And I had found some people who are good theorists and thinkers, and I worked with when I was graduating, but I felt like the U.S. had a way more intense, at least critical theory background. And so that's why I came to Columbia, and Peter was actually my thesis presentation, and was interested in a text I was presenting, and said to me, can you send me the text? And I was like, sure, can I have an interview? And that's how we exchanged it. And I worked for Peter, and I really, really have to say, it's very impressive to me, like, to kind of see how he combines theory and construction, which is really extremely tough, and he's very consistent in it. So to me, you know, I know people talk about how difficult it is maybe to work for Peter. I think Peter, you know, is tough because what he does is really difficult, and we had, you know, a lot of hours on how to get it together and how to do that. And I think, to me, I guess I focused on the, what I thought was important is that it's super, super interesting, and I wanted to really be there and had a great time. I worked there for 2.5 years.
I will agree that that Eisenman is a terrific theory teacher. As he was just launching his academic career, he arrived at Cooper Union, and I took his class for 2 years running. He called it Breaking the Box, and he likes to talk about that, how Frank Lloyd Wright changed architecture by removing the corners of the box. And Eisenman was just a really terrific teacher in terms of teaching a way of thinking about form. What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
How to actually actively look at a building.
Yeah.
But I have severe disagreements with his stance about architecture and what a lot of us like to call the social contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of your interests, too. Let's take a little musical break and then come back to social contract. This is Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. We're speaking with Wynka Dubbeldum, a New York-based Dutch architect. If anybody's listening live and you'd like to call in, call the studio, 718-497-2128. That's in North America, of course. I have no idea how you call New York from overseas. You'll have to figure that out. I always have to do research before I go overseas. You're like, how do I call home? Social contract, I think, is very important. I think the whole reason that, or the fact that we are licensed to practice, comes with it an implied social contract between the public and us as architects, as people who populate the landscape with what could be big mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thinking?
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting thing because obviously I'm licensed in Holland and work here with an architect of record in a very, very tight collaboration. And I notice, especially I teach since, actually ever since I graduated, I've been teaching at Columbia, Harvard, now I'm at Penn. And the difference between in education, you know, where we got like an 8-year study in architecture,
uh-huh,
and a year of practical training before we're supposed to be anything near an office.
Right.
It's quite interesting to me how here it is so short that people have to get used to a profession which is so difficult.
It's interesting that you say that's short. Most American degrees are 4 years, that architecture is 5 or 6,
mm-hmm,
strikes some people as peculiar. When I was finishing my undergraduate studies with John Haydick at Cooper, I think maybe we're going to have a caller. Has somebody called in, actually? Hello? No. Our dean said, you got to go to graduate school.
Hello?
5 years is not enough. Welcome to Burning Down the House.
Hello? Duo here.
Oh, hi. Thanks for calling. Is this the famous Duo? Hello?
Hi, Duo here.
This is a really bad connection. Joe, maybe you could get a phone number from the caller and call him back. I think that was Duo Dickinson, who's been...
We're trying to get Duo back on the line.
All right, great. And so I did a sixth year at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And still, that was, I mean, you know, of course, in practice, we keep learning.
Yeah, no, totally.
Which is why it's an old person's game.
Yeah.
Because there's so much to learn.
Yeah.
But where I really have to differ with Eisenman is that architecture isn't just making forms. Otherwise, we're just decorators or sculptors.
Yeah.
I have listened to a couple of fairly recent lectures that he's given, where he says that making the world better. I don't care about that. That's not the point of architecture.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I feel like it's interesting to come from a social democratic country like Holland and then end up here. And as much as I do think it's important that we are designers, it's also important to understand what you're saying, right? I mean, there's a certain incorporation of us in culture and in society,
mm-hmm.
and especially architects, I think, are very in tune with that.
Duo, are you on the line?
I'm here, but it's not good.
Well, let's just go forward. I guess this isn't going to work for calling it. Must be something wrong with the ether today. That's too bad. Yeah, well, one of the problems, I think, in the United States is that our architects are not really well integrated with society.
Mm.
There's too much of people talking to each other instead of talking to the general public or addressing urban design issues,
mm-hmm.
or even thinking about the impact of what we do on society. I mean,
yeah, it's interesting. You know, like, it's interesting that you see it that way, because in Holland we think of it the other way around. And I just did with my students, we cooperated with Tom Main, who works, Tom Main is talking to Obama about the state of the American city, and he's working with his students on that in UCLA, and he invited a bunch of schools to cooperate in this. So we cooperated in this, and we looked at the state of, funny enough, a year ago, at the state of the coastal cities and flooding, and mm-hmm. you know, we looked at New Orleans, New York, and LA. So earthquakes, mudslides, floods, oil spills, garbage problems, whatever, no?
Sure.
And it was interesting because that was the first time I saw in the U.S. actually that architects or the architectural profession integrated with government. And in Holland, that's actually the other way around. Like, city planning will invite professionals to work with them and be consultants and have a very, very tight collaboration
mm-hmm.
with many age groups and many levels of, you know, big offices, small offices, whatever, and have a really big dialogue all the time. And as we know, you can only learn through dialogue. But I find it intriguing here that the distance from any institute or any governmental regulatory kind of organization is so large to the professional environment. And to me, that's kind of shocking, because I feel, as you, that we should be tightly working together on how to develop our cities and how architecture operates within that. So one thing which actually recently happened, which I thought was really great and was also before Sandy, is there was a think tank between the AIA, the downtown center, organized that with city planning and Bloomberg's office, and asked a bunch of architects to kind of think about what it would mean for the city, what do we do with this flooding issue.
Right.
And it was quite weird that it happened, I think, 6 months before we had this whole thing happening. But it was interesting to see that even the way they posed the question to me was very limited. Like, they didn't ask us to come up with a solution. They actually told us what the solution was, and then we could design it. And I thought it was mesmerizing to me, because
what was their solution?
Well, their solution was to eliminate basically New York's ground floor. So that was kind of shocking to me, because I think the ground floor is retail and businesses, and that's what makes money, right? We're sitting on the ground floor right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how can you eliminate a ground floor? Plus, we all know that that's the structural stability of a building. So you can't just take out, you know, the brick of old townhouses and make it into a breakaway wall and whatever. So as a Dutch person, I was sitting there kind of flabbergasted and thinking, oh, wow, this is really peculiar. And I'm like, so where is really the flooding zone? And why don't we put, you know, topological elevated, you know, landscape elements there, like dikes.
Like dikes or seawalls.
Exactly. So, you know, and that's probably also the first thing, right? Like, how do we start to ask the right question? Is really... Mm-hmm. Bergson actually said this once, Bergson, the philosopher. It's not... We shouldn't be solving problems. We should be learning how to ask the right question.
Yeah. That's not unique. Well, it goes back to Eastern philosophy, even. Mm-hmm. It's not the answer that's so important. It's asking the right question.
Yeah, yeah.
My own thoughts about flooding go along the lines that are similar to yours. And I look at the development of all the water edges in the boroughs into parks, mm-hmm. as... accidentally, really, it's land banking. So now all of this is in the public control. Mm-hmm. And so if we have to build seawalls, the land has already been, you know, occupied by the city government. What that would look like, I don't know. There could be parks on top of these seawalls. On the other hand, when it's not flooding... You know, how does it work?
Mm-hmm.
If we look at some of the riverbanks in Paris, you know, it's the river's down there, but there's stone sort of surge walls that have been built, and they're rather beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
They're done by the French, and the French know how to cut stone. You know, Paris is a city of stone buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny that they told you what the solution is going to be. I don't disagree with the necessity of moving utilities to the second or third floor. But there are problems. How do you run an elevator when the pit's full of water? You can run the elevator from, say, the second or third floor to the second or third floor from the top. Can't run it all the way up and down because the counterweight's going to end up in the water.
Mm-hmm.
That's not so good.
Mm-hmm.
At least not with current roping of elevators.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. No, it's always really interesting to think about these things. I mean, we're currently working more internationally, and what's interesting is that these kind of problems happen everywhere. You know, it's not like...
Oh, yeah.
It's not a local problem, because if you don't have floods, like I'm working in Africa we're actually working pro bono on an orphanage and a school in Africa, and you look at what kind of problems they have. Ours are like minimal.
You mean like not enough water in some parts of Africa?
Well, yeah, this is in Liberia, and it's more they were actually quite well developed, but the 10 or 15 years of civil war have destroyed a lot, so their infrastructures are very, very compromised.
Sure.
But, you know, it's interesting, because I looked at the amount of thinking you have to do to build in their way, and that to me was really great, because then when you come back, you look at existing systems and what we have in a very different way. And I find that understanding how most of the world actually has to operate, how lucky we are, is quite clarifying in a weird way. So, you know, when Sandy happened, in a weird way, we were out for a few days, but we're also back very fast. And so maybe it's just a matter of thinking of it differently.
In some places, though, I mean...
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Staten Island was in total nightmare.
Oh, yes, and a lot of Queens and...
Yeah. Yeah.
All along the southern shore,
yeah,
of Long Island. A few weeks ago, I was out at Breezy Point.
Yeah, no, it's a nightmare.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
I don't know. But Venice floods almost every year.
Holland floods every year.
And
big parts of the world flood every year.
Sure.
Yeah.
And yeah. And in Venice, they leave the shops open. Even, I mean,
yeah.
They might be waist deep in water, but they're still
yeah.
their shops are still open.
Yeah,
somehow they figured this out. But it's only a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's what you said. Like, I think once you get used to, I mean, in Holland, we flood every year. And actually, funny enough, it doesn't come from the ocean. It comes from the floodwaters from Switzerland and Austria. Mm-hmm. All those rivers come through Holland, or some of them. And so we flood actually because of melting water from snow, mostly, because the ocean we kind of have under control. But what you realize is that you just get used to it. So it's what you said. You make sure that the utilities are higher. We have a saying, sandbags in front of the door when something, you know, catastrophic happens. And that is from that, right? I mean, we all have sandbags. Sandbags in front of the door is a kind of not even a saying. It's a natural thing. And when I saw that for the first time in New York, I was like, oh, wow, that's how we all in Holland were, like, you know, operating.
We, here in New York, we didn't have enough sandbags.
Yeah, and they also didn't put them very practically, I noticed.
Yeah, you know, well, there's not a lot of experience in sandbagging.
No. There were like three little sandbags, and I was like, you're supposed to like really cover the whole thing and make sure the water doesn't like get past.
But yeah. Well, it's not like it was a surprise. People have been asking for years and years and years what's going to happen when a really big storm comes.
Yeah.
I was doing sort of a due diligence review service for a construction lending arm of a bank. And one of the buildings that I was inspecting and vetting was 90 Washington Street. And the lead banker said, what happens when the next big storm comes? What can we do about that? And I said, Steve, actually nothing. He said, well, what about pumps? I said, well, yeah, where are you going to pump it to? And that building had its all of its utilities destroyed because the switchgear was in the basement. And I mean, so there are many buildings in Lower Manhattan that are still out of service because just an incredible amount of removal and replacement that has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, moving utilities up is great. But just to give up and don't use the ground plane, that doesn't work. Elevated walkways keep coming around. About every 20 years, somebody says, oh, let's have, you know, elevated walkway. No, those don't work.
No.
It's a great creative challenge, but how do we get conversations in front of the public?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the reasons that we do this program is to allow people who are interested lay people or recent students who kind of miss, you know, honest conversations, and entree to the kinds of things that we talk about with each other in the profession, but that because one, construction is so expensive, therefore two, our services tend to be expensive for the ordinary person, so people don't really they don't meet us, they don't know what kinds of things that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I've started a new project, and I think I'm going to collaborate with the writer Guy Horton, who's out in L.A., a series of essays about the shape of things that work, picking up with the sentiment that David Chipperfield expressed in an interview at the beginning of this last year's Biennale, where... And this is not unique to Chipperfield. It goes back centuries. That if we're only talking about what things look like, then we're just decorators.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could not endorse that more. So mm-hmm. What I'm hoping is to do some essays. Maybe they'll be show up in Metropolis. Guy pitched at Metropolis, and they said yes. About if we're going to make shape, shouldn't it do something?
Yeah.
You know, and not just be sculptural.
No, I think you're totally right. I mean, it was kind of shocking to me when we did the Greenwich building, which has a folded glass curtain wall. We did that because we wanted to integrate the inside a private space with the city in a completely new way, to have people see the sky for a change, or to be able to look down on the street and to have reflections of the street, or collapse maybe even the street and the sky and the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And also like work and kind of thinking about the facade as inhabitable rather than a separative membrane, to actually be something you occupy, you know, like to have pleasure from. And so we were working with those kind of ideas. And then when the building was done, I got a flood of developers who came to me and said, yeah, we have someone who does like, you know, cheap floor plans, and then we just need someone to like design a facade. And I was like, well, I'm not a cosmetic surgeon, sorry. You know, I feel architecture is about space and space we occupy. And to me, it's all about that. And so I can't separate either inside from outside, or do just a facade or anything like that. Because to me, actually, I design probably buildings from the inside out. In Europe, we also don't have necessarily a separation between interior design and exterior. So if we design a building, you do the whole building.
Well, it used to be that here there was not that distinction. But one thing that happened here in the United States is that there are a lot of design schools.
Mm-hmm.
And how good the education actually is debatable. Even good schools might not have particularly good teachers or courses from time to time. So we have a lot of people who have some design training, and you don't need a license in most places to be an interior designer.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of dilutes the income stream for fully capable architects.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of corporate interiors myself, which is okay, although there's not a whole lot that you can do when your client wants cubicles. I mean, you know, they want cubicles, you have to, you know, do cubicles. Not everybody's ready to have a Google-style workplace, mm-hmm. where with soft furniture and small breakout rooms and things like that. I totally understand what you're saying about the inside and the outside, and certainly the habitable wall is one of my favorite things to play with. I think of and it may have come from Dutch constructivism, actually,
mm-hmm.
the notion of a doorway could be more than just an opening in a plane, but have depth, which got me looking at, monastery design.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really wonderful array of buildings in Portugal that was the headquarters of the Knights Templar. And you'll see in the monks' rooms that the wall has been sculpted. Within the thickness of the wall is a place for the monk to sit, and there's an inclined surface for a manuscript right by the window. And it's permanent. You don't need furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was fabulous. Yeah. And it's gotten me thinking about what is the essence of home,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that hardly ever happens in real estate development today, where the commodity of a residential unit really doesn't ask the question of what's specific about this particular site?
Mm-hmm.
What's specific about this building's response to its solar orientation? What are the good views? What are the not so good views?
Mm-hmm.
Why is a window of a certain size placed where it is? These are questions that don't get asked. We see the, you know, either the universal glass facade, which, no offense to you, but I have some misgivings about that.
About what?
About an all glass facade.
Well, you know, I mean, that's kind of interesting because people often say, for example, about Granite Street, that's all glass. It's actually all concrete, and there's one facade glass, and that's the west one. All the other ones are completely solid and, you know, cavity walls with massive insulation. I actually have an apartment in there. I remember moving in and had lived in Soho in an old loft before. And I remember the first day I was in there by myself, and I was thinking, my God, where is everyone? It was dead silence. And I opened the window. I was like, oh, okay, that's where they are. And I realized if you build in a European way, you actually hear nothing from the outside and you hear nothing from your neighbors.
Ideally.
Yep, yep. And I had lived long enough at that point in New York that I wasn't used to that anymore. But now it's hard for me to actually move anywhere else because, you know, not many buildings in New York are built in a very good soundproof way. In Europe, we tend to build double, you know, stone or concrete or brick cavity walls. And, you know, the whole wall configuration and we're used to dealing with lots of water. So, you know, we have ventilation and all that kind of stuff. So we have massive training in how to get buildings to be good living environments. And a lot of it has to do with the materials and the way you deal with water and the way you deal with ventilation.
Yeah.
And I think here it's shocking to me if I see living environments which essentially are extremely bad for your health just because they're not well ventilated and they're not well, they don't deal with humidity and moisture and condensation in any way, shape or form. So it's quite strange sometimes to see things built here where I'm like, okay, I can't live here because, so but for me to buy something here is extremely hard. But it's one, that's probably one of the things you're talking about. Like, and I don't know that you can teach that people in an education. But it is important, I think, that we as a profession start to handle that better. And it's partially educating our client or developers.
And that's very difficult.
Yeah.
Because they'll say, well, the competition, and I know you know, when a project is being proposed, they'll look at all the comparable buildings, the comps, and they'll go around, they'll tour, and they'll say, well, okay, over here, this is what they did, and a lot of it is superficial.
Yeah, but don't forget, like, the buyers are getting much more educated. So I actually asked some of my clients, like, what do you think? Because I'm very lucky, I think, with my clients. They're really good, and we've only built buildings which are very high quality, but you know, it's. I asked them, like, do you feel that that's important? And they said, well, actually, the clients are getting much more sophisticated. People used to buy just an apartment from a floor plan, no, in a broker's catalog or whatever, and they don't anymore. They actually look at how a building is being built, are much more conscious of that, and thank God, you know, Leeds as good or bad as it is. It has made a lot of developers much more conscious of all those aspects. Mm-hmm. And I think ever since that started, there's been a huge improvement. And I think also, you know, especially in New York, I think developers starting to see that good design, and not only aesthetic good design, but good design in many ways, starts to make money and, you know, gives you good name as a developer and helps. And the city, of course, you know, the whole good design department they started, Amanda Bird has started, is really important because it stimulates that kind of thinking. So I think slowly there's definitely a better awareness. I actually was in that, there was a competition for this, you know, the big windmills in front of Cape Cod.
Oh, yes.
And I was in the jury for that. It was a design competition. And one of the jurors was the guy who had designed the Leeds whole thing and was no longer part of it, but he was the one who actually Mr. Leeds, I guess. And
do you remember his name?
I think he might have. I don't remember his name, but maybe it was even his name. But it was quite interesting to hear his version of it, no? Because, I mean, he started that as a very idealistic way of thinking, and in a way I find
You mean, what's his name, David Gottlieb?
Yeah, exactly.
I met him last year.
Yeah, very nice man.
Yeah, he's moved on to other things,
yeah.
But USGBC goes on.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and you're right. It's a good thing that it exists because it has caused people to have to talk about some of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
I would love to for there to be an understanding of certain aspects to a habitation of being a basic human right.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've heard, but I've not been able to track down. Anything in writing that at one point Finland had standards, like basic standards for quality of housing that they identified as a basic human right.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found what that was.
Every Northern European has done. Northern European country has done.
Yes?
Yeah, we all have done. Yeah, it's not necessary. It's not the most, we call it the MAT system, M-A-T. And it basically describes a living room as, you know, a certain square footage and the kitchen and all every space you occupy. And there's like kind of minimum sizes for it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, as minimum wage in Europe is, in Northern Europe, is much higher than here. Same with the minimum housing requirements are much higher than here. And I think here they're actually going the opposite, right? I mean, Bloomberg's new initiative of microhousing is actually doing the kind of opposite.
I think that's obscene. I really do. I just, and I hope it dies. Unless they understand that very tiny dwellings. And this is one of the things that I think should be established as a basic human right. Have some kind of connection to the outside, either a terrace,
mm-hmm.
Or looking over some planted area, so that you have some sort of. And I don't really like this word, but there is no better word that I know. Biophilic
mm-hmm.
element, as understood. As a basic necessity for habitation,
yeah.
Even if it's a Juliet balcony with French doors, you open so at least you can stick your head out beyond the exterior plane of your building to, you know, look at the sky, as you say, or look down the street, or, you know, check out what the weather is,
mm-hmm.
And that's not an expensive thing to do. But it, where you find that, it totally transforms the nature of the living space.
No, totally. And I mean, that happens very little, right? Especially
absolutely.
In Manhattan.
Yeah.
Brooklyn is much nicer, or, you know, the outer edges of Manhattan are much more friendly that way. But the other thing I think which it needs to have, and I was looking at it, is I think if you have a micro unit, you kind of need to have a lot of common spaces. So mm-hmm. then the idea becomes different. It becomes like, okay, my unit is small because I share a lot of my activities with the other people who live here, you know, and it's kind of like...
Yeah, and that goes then in the direction of collaborative housing.
Yeah.
Which is really not taken seriously here in the United States. You know, we all, as a sort of a national mindset, we have to own our own backyard. We have to own our own Weber grill. We have to have our own car. We have to have, you know, our little plot of land. For most Americans, mass transit doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
A couple months ago, I was moderating a discussion of people who design and build single-family houses. And they defended to the end that not only is the sort of suburban American style of life got a future, but that it is superior to being in a city and having to rely on somebody else to drive you around, which I found very fascinating. Because I personally, after 19 years living in very quaint, very pretty suburban Connecticut, sold my car, moved back to the city. So I just became exhausted at having to drive everywhere.
Yeah.
But cars are not going to go away. I mean, all over the world, there are so many places that simply don't work mm-hmm. without an automobile.
Yeah.
our automotive fascination has infected, you know, the whole world. I mean, the old ways of getting around just simply aren't there. Although, you have much better train service in Europe. That is great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you arrive in any European airport and you pop in the train and you're in the city.
Yeah.
It's like super, super easy. And it makes a huge difference. Because there's like, if you see how many million people arrive per day in an airport in a big city.
Yeah.
If you put all those people on a train instead of in taxis, it's enormous. It's a huge difference.
I know. It's almost an impossible notion that New York will ever have that. I mean, there's no reason that it couldn't, but it took them decades to get the air train going to JFK. And that is so cumbersome and so slow that it's really not a very attractive alternative to taking a taxi.
Why don't we have a normal subway going, a fast, like, express subway going to the airport? Well,
there is a train, but you got to change. You know, you got to change
it. It's a
slow
one, yeah.
Yeah, and it's slow. And it's cumbersome. I mean, because our trains are not set up for luggage.
You know what's funny? I'm laughing because I, at some point, there was, I forget it, like a History Channel, I think. They asked 10 architects in New York, 10 architects in Chicago, and I think 10 architects in LA. And we got 3 days to think of the future of our city. And then I think in within that day or an extra day to build an installation. And in our case in New York, it was in Grand Central. And when I got that question, I was like, wow, that's so interesting. Because as a European living in New York, I always think it's interesting because New York was the first to have everything, like the subway and whatever, you know. But then it's now the most behind because it has that kind of disadvantage. And I thought what is the future for New York is really to rethink all its infrastructure. So, you know, I looked at a train track which would run through the river, which would be for transport of goods and people.
Yeah.
And it would replace the highways along Manhattan so that you would have flood landscapes. I had bioenergy, an island in the New York Bay for bioenergy, so all the waste would become energy. I put sunflowers to clean up harbor pollution because sunflowers are great for that. Anyway, long story short, blah, blah, blah. I was very excited about it myself. And I put also like, you know, new house because, and oh, and I took out the bridges, which was, you know, because the bridges are kind of ancient. They take up a lot of land everywhere. And I put buildings there. And what was really funny about it is I had to present this, right, in Grand Central Station. And I think, and it was for people of the city and AIA and whatever, Van Allen Institute. I think it was all, like all kinds of interesting people in that jury. And I thought they were going to faint when I said what I wanted to do because I took out all the romantic aspects. I was being a Dutch pragmatist, right? Mm-hmm. I took out all the romantic things of New York, like the bridges that are beautiful. And I think they're beautiful too, but the beautiful structure.
Some of them are beautiful. I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge
is
beautiful. Some of the other bridges,
they're kind of nice when you go in a boat under them. You know, I love looking up at them. But So I kind of understood it. It was really interesting to see the amount of resistance because, you know, this is easily 5 years ago or something.
Hmm.
It was clear to me that we needed floodscapes. Now, in Holland, we have every river has big floodland next to it. No,
sure.
You can use it all the time.
Right.
But in moments of emergencies, there, you know, it's land you don't inhabit. You can have parks, you can have tennis, you can have parking, you can have whatever you want, but you don't live there.
Even in American cities, some American cities.
Yeah.
Where people learned their lesson from a really disastrous flood, you will see floodlands and levees.
But isn't it interesting that people are like they were horrified when they saw my proposal. And I thought that was kind of interesting because I was like, people are so not ready for the fact that this city is ancient and that it really needs repair. You know, I remember just when I came to New York, there was a big hole in the... I remember like on the Upper East Side, there was a big hole in the street and there were cars like hanging half into it.
Oh, that happens every so often, yeah.
Right. I thought it was fascinating because in Europe, ground is ground most of the time. You know, there's like ground. Here we're living on air, you know, it's all systems.
And, oh, yeah.
And that's, to me, really, really interesting, but it's also a little scary.
I believe that there are still water pipes made out of wood in some parts of Manhattan.
Wow.
I mean, because the municipal water system was begun in the middle of the 19th century. The stuff it requires replacement every so often, and it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take another little break and then come back in a couple minutes. Burning Down the House, we're speaking with Wynka Dubbeldum, architect, and we've been talking about urban design issues, and it's been quite fascinating. I would like to see a Manhattan, Wynka, that got rid of cars as much as possible. And what I don't understand is why we don't bring back streetcars. See, to me, ideally, because we have subway lines that pretty much run in Manhattan anyway, north and south, and they work very well. If we had a streetcar on every other street, shall we say, you'd only have to walk a short block to get to a streetcar to take you to the subway.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, we used to have trolleys. There were trolleys all over in Brooklyn. It's why the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team was called the Dodgers, because people had to dodge streetcars that, you know, were in the street along with everybody else. I believe that they work very, very well. I mean, you know, Boston still has one line on the T that becomes a streetcar, you know, the green line, when it gets out towards Huntington Avenue or something. And they're inexpensive as compared with the horrible, like, digging on the Second Avenue subway. I mean, what a mess that is made of the Upper East Side, and it's just enormously expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why we don't have streetcars. I mean, and they're civilized, you know? I mean, you know, they stop at regular places, and you get on and you go. I mean, okay, we have buses. Buses are great.
What about bikes? I have a bike. We should all bike.
I have a bike, too.
No one has to go to the gym, you know? It's much better. In Holland, we bike, whether it snows, rains. We actually turn
bikes
ourselves
okay.
into, like, yellow plastic people because we put on these rain suits. We don't care how we look. And we bike, you know, through any weather.
That's great.
Yeah.
I would not want to bike from where I live on the Upper West Side here to Bushwick.
That would be too far. Yeah.
First of all, it's 15 miles. Second of all, it's across a bridge.
Yeah.
And I would feel kind of vulnerable. I know people do it all the time. They take their bikes across the bridges. But I think I would find that a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I understand. I understand. But, you know, it's I think public transport in Manhattan is amazing. I think probably if you did any trams anywhere, you would want to have them out in Brooklyn, Queens, you know, the suburbs, because we have pretty good transport in Manhattan. It's very easy to hop on a subway, and that is not that hard. It's when you get out here that it gets a bit more sporadic. You know, there's like there's still subway, but the subway lines are so far apart that it gets much more prevalent, I think, here to have a nice tram or whatever. And you have more space here. So
that's
I think it's definitely a good idea. I mean, you know, the electric systems are really, really good. I think what happens in Europe, what we try and do is we try and discourage having a car by just making it really expensive. I mean, I was just there and I was shocked looking at my gas bill when I got some gas for the car. I was like, oh my God, it's like we have the same price there, but for a liter, which is, you know, a quarter gallon.
Right.
So it was kind of a shocker to use the car there. And so that's what they do. But you know what? People still use the car. And although we have trams and whatever, it's you can slow it down. And I think in Manhattan, they had this Danish advisor for the city who came, who puts bike lanes everywhere, right? So I hear taxis complain about it every day or every time I take a taxi.
Oh, yeah.
They hate it. But I think it's good. I mean, I bike everywhere, so... I call it the office limo. And it's good because, you know, you don't get hit every 5 minutes by a car being swung open into the bike lane.
You really have to watch out.
You have to really watch out, but the chances are much less now because of the way everything is reorganized.
Physical separation, right?
Yeah, which is good. And I think that's a really great initiative because the moment it's painful to narrow the roads, but it does discourage people from driving in the city. I never drive. I have a car, but I never drive in the city. I just drive to, you know, anywhere out of the city.
Yeah. Well, this is the first time that I have not had a car since 1976.
Wow.
and a lot of those years I lived in Manhattan and I kept a car.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, I had a Pacer.
Oh, really?
I had an AMC Pacer for 10 years.
Oh,
I loved my Pacer.
Really?
Yeah, Elizabeth. She died.
That's one of those cars. It was so ugly that it was
beautiful.
Cute. Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't believe it. It was like having a dog. Like, people would talk to you. I had people in Mercedes or in like the most expensive cars on the highway in some traffic jam. They would hang out of their window going like, I am so jealous of your car. I love your car. Blah, blah. Or they would go, oh, my grandmother had one like this as well. And just like, it was a whole like conversation piece. But she was fantastic. I mean, I bought her for $2,000 and she drove 10 years. So we had a good stretch together. Yeah. She's from 76.
Wow.
Adorable. And she was actually an amazing design because, well, she wasn't really compact in European thinking. I mean, it was kind of a short square car.
Yeah.
But the whole bubble window thing was really, really amazing.
Oh, I kind of liked it. To me, that automobile looked like a gondola for a funicular, you know? It's sort of like
her back looked like the front of a helicopter.
Yeah.
I'm always a little bit envious of car designers, so I tend to have a, although I'm a woman, I tend to have a bit of a love for cars.
Yeah, I read here somewhere in something that I found online, an interview that Metropolis had with you, where you said that your goal is to incorporate ideas from car detailing in your buildings.
Yeah, I find that, you know, I love architecture, but I find that the way we build is so archaic, and why not use a lot of the inventions we have in car, plane, and whatever design or industrial design? And it's happened before. I mean, you know, like, why not gasket glass? Why do we use cork, which falls apart in like 15 years? You know, cork is like the worst thing ever.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not even good because it always leaks. But, you know, gasketing for windows, for example, is a really good way of getting a window waterproof and windproof and whatever proof. So I love to think about that, and I try and incorporate as much as possible as I can every time I work on detailing. But it's quite an interesting struggle, not with clients or with industries or manufacturers, but with contractors who are kind of used to gluing everything together. It's like a glue mania going on.
Yeah, that's true. For better or worse, some of the very best building technology right now happens to be in curtain wall.
Well, curtain wall or prefab. I did a lot of prefab design in Europe. I just built my parents a prefab house, and not prefab as in you put a box on the truck and you deliver the box, but really like completely custom design it and then fabricate panels and have a truck with a big crane on it deliver the panels, and then within 3 or 4 days you have the whole kind of construction. And prefab construction I use also a lot for building components and stuff like that, and that's where you get a real precision. You can manufacture it in a protected environment, clean protected environment. The fitting is, you know, highly precise.
Yeah.
You can incorporate wall and window in one jump, so it's not like everything comes like uncoordinated and ends up in a dirty construction site and then has to somehow fit. Mm-hmm. So I am a big proponent of, and I think it's much more economic and much more environmentally friendly. You don't have waste
it or can
not
be,
as
yes.
much. Yeah.
I know of a project in New York. Again, it was one that I did inspection for. So it was entire gut renovation of apartments. And they had all of their millwork and all of their doors and all of the door frames prefabricated. They were Italian, these components. And they were the most beautiful thin frames, and the doors were so well balanced that you just touch it and it would close and it would just click shut.
Yeah, that's normal.
But buyers,
I consider that normal.
But buyers, and these were beautiful, beautiful doors because they were finished with polyester lacquer.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Exactly.
And
epoxy, yeah.
And beautiful finished hardware, you know. But people said, I don't see the quality. You know, I want a door with, I want a heavy door, a solid door. Well, these doors were light as a feather, but they were gasketed. So well, they were
totally soundproof, yeah.
So they were acoustically superior. They had drop bottoms that closed the threshold when they latched. They were beautiful, but they weren't what people are somehow thinking is quality. I mean, the New York standard door, which is a hollow metal frame, you know, in 16 gauge steel, is considered good. But then, you know, a gasketed aluminum frame that's elegant and light is seen as somehow being cheap, when in fact that Italian door costs more than.
Mm-hmm. But that's just education, I think. You know, that's something people get used to. I mean,
well, how do your clients find you? It sounds like you have pretty well educated clients.
Well, I thought when I came out of working for a bunch of offices in school, and I thought there's two ways to start a practice. And one is like you take all the work you can and you make money, and two is you teach. Make money, and you focus on what you want to do and go slow.
Yeah.
So I decided to the last one, which economically is probably disastrous because the first, whatever, 5 years, I definitely didn't make any money.
That's the model that Peter Eisenman has used.
Yeah.
That is the model that Stephen Holt used.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, yeah, and exactly. And I just thought, you know, I didn't study for that long to then start doing things I don't believe in and I feel ripped off intellectually. So I felt like I'd rather wait and I go slower and I do the things I believe in. And then hopefully people come to me. And I think that I've also been very lucky. But yeah, that has happened. And, you know, I was extremely fortunate that in 1997... I started my business in architectonics in 1994. Uh-huh. And in 1997, Terry Riley invited us to participate in the Unprivate House show in MoMA, which definitely helped.
How did you know Terry?
I knew Terry, I guess I met him socially, but he was the Buell Hall director at Columbia, and uh-huh. I was teaching at Columbia.
Okay.
So I met him there, and... and I started my office in 94. And I also had, I was really lucky because when I worked for Peter, I had a whole bunch of people working with me on projects. And one of them was a really nice guy. And he came out of Peter's office. He went to LA and he started a beautiful bookshop slash gallery, art architecture gallery called Form Zero. And he worked for me in Peter's office and he offered me a solo show. So my office was, I think, half a year old. And we had a solo exhibit of the work. I had done some work in Holland. I'd built some work in Holland. I had an office in Holland already before I came here.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I had an exhibit of my work in LA, 95, I think.
Huh.
And that became my first book, which was kind of peculiar because I just started my office. So there was a lack in the first 3 years of my office was a massive amount of stuff going on, which basically happened because I had an office in Holland already and I worked for quite a few architects in Holland. I came to the US, then worked for a bunch of architects here. So I had a long history of doing stuff.
But you never worked for REM.
I worked with REM. Yeah, I never worked in his office, but I worked for a small office in Holland called BOA, which is not Bank of America, but Beware of Architects. That's actually how they were called. And we worked very closely with REM, and I saw REM every day. So REM actually recommended me to Stephen Hall. That's how I got my job at Stephen Hall. And still a good friend. He's an amazing tutor and model to follow. I mean,
yeah, he's a very interesting character.
Yeah, very. Yeah,
he's done very well for promoting the REM brand of, and you know, he was at the Institute.
Yeah, exactly.
With Peter.
Yeah.
And
Frederica Taylor, who is my gallerist.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Frederic actually worked very closely with both of them. Yeah.
Yes, I know those crew. That was really getting going about the time that I departed New York and returned to Chicago for a few years. So I never really got to know the Institute gang all that well. But on the other hand, I got to know Stanley Tigerman and Tom Beebe and people of that age range in Chicago.
Yeah.
Which is, it was a very exciting time to be a young architect in Chicago.
Yeah, very, very. We invited Stanley to come to a lecture in Holland, and I was the one who had to be his transporter and had the tiniest car because, you know, being Dutch, we had this small, small car.
Oh, sure.
And so every time I had to change gears, I had to ask Stanley, could you please pull over a little bit? Because change gears. And it was really fantastic. He gave the best lecture and we were so impressed with him. And I've actually, and then, you know, somehow we always stayed in contact. And the other day, it was a few years ago, there was an exhibit in the museum in Washington. What is it? The Building Museum.
Uh-huh.
And Stanley was the curator. And it was really, really nice to see him again. And, you know, he had a think tank, right, in Chicago. I thought it was an amazing... That's the one thing I wanted to say to you. Like, what I like about the career REM has built for himself is that he started to open up the idea of an architect being a thinker and an architect potentially being a consultant. And I think that is underrated in the U.S. You know, we are not seen as thinkers. And I think architects, because we cover so many different parts of society and so many different professions.
Yes.
I think we are very well equipped to understand more complex problems. And I think in a weird way, we're underused in that sense. And that's why I was very excited to see that think tank in New York about the flood zones. I've done another one in the UN about the city of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should be involved in many more things like that because we have... Just because we're trained to think like that, you know, we're trained to think on multiple levels with multiple professions, with complex problems. And I think that's what REM opened up. And REM also really has kind of a strong opinion about it in a very often kind of sarcastic, ironic kind of way.
Which is fine.
Which is great. Yeah, which is very good. I mean, I think a sense of humor is very, very important in progressing in any way, shape, or form.
I couldn't agree more. I think we've run way past our allotted time. This has been fascinating. This has been great. This has been Burning Down the House for the 6th of January, 2013, speaking with Winka Doubledum. Thanks for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.